Not a real estate deal today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump wants to jumpstart the Mideast peace process, but this Palestinian-American warns this is not a real estate deal, and Trump's real motive may be different.
The photo opportunity and the attention that he gets by coming to Palestine, Israel, is a perfect place for him to be able to sidetrack people from the failures that are happening on the U.S. side.
Plus, a rapper from Uganda named Keiko stays true to herself.
Everybody's like, oh, you're trying to be a man now because you want to rap and you want to dress like a tomboy. You're trying to be a man. I'm like, no, I've always been like this.
And Bonnie Raitt traces the blues from the Mississippi Delta back to Mali. That's all today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. If this is Monday, it must be Israel. That's where President Trump is today, the second stop on his first overseas trip after Saudi Arabia. In fact, Trump arrived on what was reportedly the first ever nonstop flight between Saudi Arabia and Israel. He got a warm welcome from Israeli officials, and Trump told them that his visit reaffirms the bond of friendship between Israel and the U.S.
A friendship built on our shared love of freedom, our shared belief in human dignity, and our shared hope for an Israel at lasting peace. We want Israel to have peace.
That, of course, would imply a peace deal between Israelis and Palestinians. And tomorrow, the president will talk about that with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. But few people on either side of the Israeli-Palestinian divide are as optimistic as Donald Trump.
I don't really feel that there's much he has to offer in terms of moving the peace process forward. The best he can do, I think, is to hold the ship for 4 years without causing structural damage.
That's Sam Behour, a Palestinian-American businessman living in Ramallah. And here's what he would say to President Trump if he had the chance.
Well, first and foremost, I would tell him that this is not a real estate deal. This is a historic conflict that's based in international law. If he's approaching this trying to strike any kind of deal, and as we heard him say in the White House recently, that he's up for any kind of solution, that's really saying that he's going to take the imbalance in the balance of power on the ground, which is highly in favor of the Israeli military control over the Palestinian life, and convert that to a deal. That's not a deal at all. Second, whether there's a resolution to this conflict or not, he has a responsibility to hold Israel accountable to us Palestinians who are under occupation. It makes no sense whatsoever that the Israeli boot of occupation is on our neck for the last 50 years, and president after president from the U.S. come to the Palestinians and look down upon us as we're on the ground and say, hey, let's talk. Let's find a way to deal with the Israelis. Let's get that boot of occupation off of the Palestinian neck so we can breathe and hopefully find a way to live together with the Israeli side. The last thing I would tell him is that he should beware. The Israeli government, this specific Israeli government, has chewed up and spit out international dignitaries with far higher political stature. People like James Wolferson, the ex-World Bank president, Tony Blair, the ex-UK prime minister. I don't think they'll have a problem doing the same with Trump if he tries to act in any kind of way which will hold Israel accountable. But that's exactly what's needed if we're serious.
Let's talk symbolism real quick, Sam, because a lot of these state visits are about symbolism. What's the most telling symbolic moment you think so far with this Trump trip? And what symbolic moment for you ought to have happened that hasn't?
Wow, that's a hard one. I mean, I assume in part of his agenda, he'll be making some visits to various locations in Palestine and Israel. The most symbolic thing he can do right now to show that he understands the volatility that we live in is to visit an Israeli prison and talk to some of the Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike. Or if not that, visit some of the families that have people in Israeli prisons that have never been charged. That would show that he understands the volatility that we're in. And it would also give a message to the Israeli side that regardless of what happens in the peace process, they cannot continue to violate Palestinian human rights. On the political front, the only thing I think the U.S. can do that means anything at this point is to recognize politically the state of Palestine. We as the U.S. have already recognized Israel only minutes after it was created in 1948. I think it's fair to say in 2017, recognizing the other side of the equation, the Palestinian state, is a must. That is, if we're still committed to a two-state solution. If we cannot define both states as being states, then I don't think the message is clear, not to us nor the Israelis.
Palestinian-American businessman Sam Behur there, who lives in Ramallah in the West Bank. Brokering a peace deal between Israelis and Palestinians may still be a ways off. So following the advice that you never walk away empty-handed, President Trump arrived in Israel today with a shorter-term deal, a de facto alliance with Saudi Arabia and other Sunni Arab states, countries that, like Israel, view Iran as a threat. Israeli journalist Ita Prince-Gibson joins us from Jerusalem. So as I mentioned earlier on the show, Ita, perhaps the first sign of this rapprochement is that Air Force One is believed to have been the first plane ever to fly directly from Saudi Arabia to Israel, which is a pretty potent symbol, I gather, for Israelis. And even you had a close encounter with the president's helicopter, Marine One, in your backyard in Jerusalem, yeah?
Yeah, right in front of my house, practically, it landed. But more seriously, yes, to Israelis, being accepted, being recognized is one of the most important dividends of peace, at least on a socio-political level. And the fact that the plane landed directly from Riyadh to Tel Aviv was a very moving thing. The last time that happened was when President Sadat came from Egypt for the peace agreement in the 70s.
Well, let's talk about this alliance. It's kind of fascinating because shoring up some kind of relationship between Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and Israel is kind of surprising. But when you frame it as cooperative animosity toward Iran, it starts making some sense. Will it make sense to Israelis, though? Are they confident that this will make them more secure?
Absolutely. First of all, it's building on something that, while it doesn't get a lot of press, is in fact in place, which is the Arab Peace Initiative dating back to the beginning of 2000s and reiterated only in March of this year, which is a promise of normalization with Israel in exchange for a resolution of the Israel-Palestinian problem. So, yeah, that will resonate, not only because of Iran, but also because of the promise of connections, hope, and everything that we would hope to have with the Arab countries.
I mean, Donald Trump continues to honor the nuclear deal with Iran, though, even though he said otherwise during the campaign. If you play that off, the chaos in the Trump White House, you still think Israelis will give Trump the benefit of the doubt here?
It's hard to know. I think that what Israelis will trust more is what appears to be on the table for Israel. Israelis are a pretty cynical bunch. And I think that they will look very carefully at any agreement and how well inked it is. Certainly, the agreement with Iran is not popular in Israel, even among moderates. And so anything that seems to put that at risk, as you said, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, of your enemy is my friend, that would make sense.
You were saying earlier, Ita, that the biggest dividend for Israel is just getting recognition. I mean, don't they get a lot of recognition without an alliance like this?
From the Arab countries, no.
Not
I mean, that's
Arab,
why
no.
Not from the Arab countries. And with all the reservations that many moderate and progressive Israelis have towards the Gulf countries, as I assume Americans do too, in terms of human rights and all the other issues, being recognized by an Arab state, the legitimacy of Israeli existence as a political entity being recognized. No, we don't get a lot of that. If a plane flying directly is that big a deal that it's a headline on all of the papers, then it tells you how Israelis do not feel and aren't recognized. We don't have business dealings. We have no recognition on that level from the major Arab countries.
So I just want to ask you one more thing, Ita, because just last week, a lot of Israelis were alarmed over President Trump's sharing of classified intelligence with the Russians, which apparently came from Israel and could have compromised a sensitive Israeli intelligence operation. Is there any evidence of that anger today?
No. There's evidence of the same divisions that you see in the United States that you see here, but that's not coming up. It is very much in Netanyahu's interest, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's interest, to have this go well. It's very much in Trump's interest to have this go well, and that's not being played up at all.
Israeli journalist Ita Prince-Gibson, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The Department of Homeland Security announced today that it's going to extend the temporary protected status for Haitians here in the U.S. Temporary protected status is a program that lets tens of thousands of people to stay in this country. As the name suggests, the status is supposed to be temporary, but is constantly being debated. Farah Larieux is one of the Haitians who has benefited from TPS. She joins us from Florida. So given the current climate in Washington toward refugees generally, Farah, this must be a relief. Did you think it might have gone the other way?
Well, Marco, it is, I can say, a surprise, but also that's what we're fighting for, right? The reason I say surprise because just what you just mentioned about, you know, what's going on in Washington, and then there's always a fear of what they're going to do, whether or not they will extend it or not. Yes, it is for us a relief, but we're also waiting for to get more information about this extension. Is it 18 months or is it 6 months? Now it's not clear yet.
How did you get to the United States?
Well, my husband, who applied for the residency petition for me, and there was complication in the process. He failed the interview, and it was due to lack of information. That's why from there they withdraw the petition residency, and then they put me on deportation proceedings. So I was on deportation proceedings for 2 years. I had an emerging businesses. I have my office, and I was doing well. And then I lost everything when they withdrew the petition. So I lost my work permit, my driver license, and then I went to depression. I was even suicidal at some point. So when the earthquake happened, I was in a process to appear in front of the immigration court for the third time to make the final decision. And I was at some point it was so tough for me that I even have money to pay for an attorney. So it was very, very dark moment of my life. And I went to hell.
So even though you were not in Haiti when the earthquake happened in 2010, you still benefited from temporary protective status?
Yes, that's what part of the status. Those who are in the United States after 2004, I think, was about to get into the program.
Farah, this protection was supposed to be temporary, but for some people it starts to look like permanent residency. What do you say to those people who see it that way?
Yes, they're right. It was supposed to be temporary. And then we Haitian also, and I think any TPS recipient for any nationalities, yes, we knew that it was temporary. So now this is the time for dialogue about immigration reform. Haiti is in bad shape. Yes, you might say that there's a new government. That doesn't mean things are good in Haiti. As a matter of fact, the numbers are there. There's a famine. It is famine declared. And this is based on United Nations report. I can mention the U.S. Government Accountability Office testimony before the House of Representatives back in 2013 showed that USAID did a very poor job in Haiti. And they testify in front of the Committee of Foreign Affairs in October 2013. And they stated USAID infrastructure projects have had mixed results and face sustainability challenges. So that means for those who think that, well, United States has been in Haiti, helping Haiti, and that we should be in a better position. But you have to understand that United States has failed Haiti. And this is the time to consider the involvement of the United States and what has been done. How come you can send people back to where they're suffering?
That's Farah Larieux, a Haitian living under temporary protected status. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Some U.S. companies took advantage of President Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia this weekend to strike a few deals, among them the Blackstone Group, co-founded by the head of Trump's business council. Conflict of interest questions aside, Blackstone is getting $20 billion in Saudi money for its new infrastructure fund, which invests mainly in U.S. projects. Joining us now is reporter Arash Masoodi with the Financial Times. So what kind of infrastructure projects is Blackstone planning for here in the U.S.?
Well, it's important to point out that these discussions between the Saudis and Blackstone have been going on for some time, and they still weren't able to concretely announce that they have a full deal here. So we have a memorandum of understanding. So it's a non-binding agreement for the moment. But essentially what they have committed to do is for the Saudis to put $20 billion into a new Blackstone fund, which will then, this Blackstone will go out and try to raise another $20 billion from investors. And with that money, they will seek to target existing U.S. infrastructure projects. And specifically, it looks like they're going to look to upgrade certain kinds of infrastructure.
I mean, it's interesting. Both Trump and Hillary Clinton mentioned infrastructure in this country on the campaign trail last year, how it's going down the tubes, how a lot of it needs to be replaced. What kind of things is this deal going to invest in? Airports and roads, bridges?
I think it's projects that are already in existence, so it won't be new build as far as I can tell. Now, what's important here is obviously the announcement coming on President Trump's first international visit would make it seem like this is some sort of win for America. Ultimately, you have two financial interests here. Obviously, you have the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is putting the money in and wants to make money with the money. And you have Blackstone, which is in the business of making money. So none of this is charity, and it shouldn't be interpreted as such. They're going to target deals where they can make money for themselves, ultimately.
So what's in this for Saudi Arabia?
Well, what's happening under this sort of dynamic, hard-charging, reformist young prince, the deputy crown prince Mohammed bin Salman, is an active attempt to wean its dependence off its own oil. And as part of that, there's economic reforms, there's social reforms, there's cultural reforms, there's a whole host of things. And one of the big projects the young prince has targeted is taking money out of the central bank and into the sovereign wealth fund, leveraging the enormous amount of funds they have to basically get influence on the global stage. So in addition to this $20 billion they plan to place with Blackstone, they have put up to $45 billion with a Japanese telecoms to technology conglomerate called SoftBank, who many people may not know, but also owns Sprint in the U.S. So they are everywhere. So that's $65 billion committed in the last 6 months to two asset managers, which is like in the game of private equity, this is an unprecedented sum of money being allocated.
So how many other countries are invested in U.S. infrastructure at this scale?
Well, it's actually hard to tell because many of the private equity funds or sovereign wealth funds or, you know, think of pension funds are all limited partners in private equity companies, which ultimately do deals in all countries around the world. So it might sound shocking that Saudi Arabia is going to be snapping up U.S. infrastructure assets as part of its own financial diversification. But that's something that's existed in the U.S. with multiple countries and multiple types of interests for many, many years. So in a sense, it's not new. It's just what's incredible about this is the sort of force of, you know, someone like Steve Schwarzman, who's both the CEO and chairman of a company and an advisor to President Trump, showing up and announcing a mega deal, which raises all sorts of questions about the dynamic between the Trump administration and business.
Is Saudi Arabia especially enthusiastic to get into the American market and work on American infrastructure, or are they kind of spreading their bets in this oil slump period all over the world?
So I think almost every country in the world where there are large companies or large interests is interested in the U.S. market. It's more open than many others. It's got a huge, huge population. It's growing faster than many economies in the world. So I think the global interest, you know, whereas maybe 5 or 7 years ago would have been towards emerging markets, has completely turned the other way and into the U.S. And if you're someone like the young prince who's trying to diversify his country's financial holdings, it's entirely logical.
That's reporter Arash Masoudi with the Financial Times there. China is also busy with some huge infrastructure projects. It's called the Belt and Road Initiative. The goal is to support Chinese trade routes throughout the world by building railways, pipelines, and ports. And where a Chinese port is built, a Chinese military presence is likely to follow. That seems to be what's happening in Djibouti, the tiny African nation on the Horn of Africa. China is in the process of building a military base there, its first ever foreign military base, after completing a commercial port there. The World Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen is keeping an eye on that story.
Djibouti is a really ideal location for a first base. For one thing, they're used to having foreign troops there. America has a base there. France has a base there. I was surprised to learn that Japan has a base in Djibouti. It's strategically located right in the aquatic pathway that takes goods and oil and all sorts of things through the Middle East up into Europe through the Suez Canal. So Djibouti is an excellent place, and also China was able to give their tiny government $14 billion of investment, and I think that buys you the right to have some foreign troops on their soil.
You said the U.S. and Japan even has a base there, so does France. What opposition has the U.S. put up to this port in Djibouti?
America actually hasn't been too belligerent about this. Where you're seeing most of the pushback is from India, because this maritime pathway, China's calling it a 21st century maritime Silk Road, through which all of China's goods and oil and everything is passing through, that's in the Indian Ocean. And India is actually very concerned that China's going to have a major naval buildup through the Indian Ocean and counter their ability to run that patch of ocean.
Colonial powers always had this two-prong kind of aim overseas in places like Africa, military and economic power. But given the disasters those colonial powers experienced, is China really after this? Do they want a big footprint, or do they have something else in mind?
They want a very big footprint, and they're very keen to juxtapose what they're doing against the, you know, rather bloody, repulsive colonial history that the European powers and, to a degree, America has had as well. They definitely want you to think about those colonial powers as bloody and brutal, and they want you to think about the new Chinese initiatives as all about peace and harmony.
So, Patrick, step back for a moment, because we've been watching for over a decade as China has really pursued economic development in Africa. This port in Djibouti, situate this moment against the rest of China's projects in Africa, which mostly seem to be about, you know, selling flip-flops and stuff from China to the African markets.
Sure. Well, that's exactly what they'd like to do. China makes a lot of stuff, and they want to expand the markets where they can sell that stuff. Toothpaste, flip-flops, as you mentioned, T-shirts, you name it. So this port in Djibouti actually has railways coming out of it all the way into Ethiopia that are stretching all throughout the continent. These are through these railways, they can get more of their goods from the port in Djibouti all the way into the interior of Africa. And so, yeah, it's all linked. And the reason that you're seeing a military buildup in Djibouti is because they want to protect these assets, and they're going to want to protect all of the oil and goods flowing through all of these railways, through all the ports, all the pipelines that they're going to be building in the coming decades.
At what point does China's military presence in places like Djibouti and wherever else they set up shop, when does that start to become a concern for other countries that are worried about their dominance and that footprint?
Well, I said America isn't too worried about Djibouti, but big picture, they are worried. Right now, basically, the U.S. Navy guarantees open passage throughout the entire world, but it's not going to remain that way. China wants to make sure that it's a presence on the seas as well. So long term, no, the U.S. isn't happy about this, and the possibility for future clashes in coming decades is very much there.
The World's Patrick Quinn. You can read more of his reporting on China's massive Belt and Road Initiative over at PRI.org.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, guitarist Bonnie Raitt tells us about the joys of making music in Mali.
You haven't lived until you've crouched at the side of a town square with somebody with a turban on, dressed like a Tuareg guy, playing an electric guitar like Jimi Hendrix.
Tracing the roots of the blues with Bonnie Raitt. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Got a couple of stories about women musicians in this half hour of the show. Both have Africa connections. One is a Ugandan rapper living in East Africa. The other is a famous American musician who plays the blues and has her connection, musical connection, in West Africa. So stick around for that. But first, a very different sort of African story. And it begins with this uncomfortable question: how much in U.S. dollars are human lives worth? Answer, about $150 billion a year. That's an estimate of how much traffickers earn globally from modern slavery. More than Coke, more than Nike, more than Microsoft. The selling of people is big business, and it's a business with many sides to it. Domestic workers forced to clean without pay, or young women lured abroad to follow their dreams, then forced into sexual slavery. Also, girls abducted from their homes and used as commodities of war. These things happen every day, both overseas and here in the U.S. Our Across Women's Lives team has been investigating a part of the trafficking story that we don't often hear about. What happens to the women who are freed from slavery? How do they rejoin their communities, reunite with their families, or get justice? We'll be hearing about this all week, starting with this story from The World's Jasmine Garst about a young woman from Nigeria who made that journey out of trafficking.
Halima was 15 when she came to England. She remembers her Aunt Miriam dressed her up.
She dressed me really smart.
Really smart. An elegant outfit, sunglasses. Before they headed to the airport, Halima grabbed the phone number she'd written on a piece of paper.
I put the number inside tissue, I wrap it, I put it inside the bag to put it under me so that it wouldn't get wet.
She wrapped the number in tissue, then in plastic, so it wouldn't get wet, and she hid it under her shirt. When they got to London, Aunt Miriam and Halima made their way to King's Cross, a massive, grimy old train station. Aunt Miriam got on the phone and started yapping away, as she often would. And that's when Halima did it.
I run as fast as I can.
She ran as fast as she could, weaved her way through the thick stream of commuters, past the beggars, and bolted out of the building, into the streets of London. And she kept running, as fast as her small legs could carry her. It's been 15 years since Halima ran out of that train station. She's almost 30 now, but there's a childlike quality about her. She has the body of a small ballerina. She's wearing glittery slippers, sparkly little earrings. And when I ask why she ran away that day, we stepped outside to talk. Halima doesn't remember much about where she's from, somewhere in Nigeria. She knows she had a good childhood there.
I'm from a middle-class family and everything was fine. We're living okay.
Her family was middle class, and she knows when she was 10 years old, her luck changed. Her dad died.
Everything changed after my dad died.
The day he died, an auntie came to pick her up at school.
Miriam.
Miriam was a relative who lived in Italy. The family decided she would take Halima and make sure she went to a great school. So Halima left her mother and siblings and was off to Europe. In Italy, they checked into a hotel.
As soon as we get to the hotel, she made a phone call for people to know we arrived and people start coming. I was in the room and she gave the other two male money and they were having argument about the money.
Halima knew that something was wrong when Aunt Miriam started arguing over money with some men.
Then I tried to open the door just to see what is going on and she asked me to go back inside the room, so I went back.
There was no home in Italy. There was no school. Here's what there was. About $50,000. That's what Halima thinks she was sold into prostitution for.
And she was like, this is your job now. You have to go with the other girls. You have to do what they do.
When Halima said no, Aunt Miriam gave her a beating. Because this was what Aunt Miriam did. She was a trafficker. There was no way out.
There's no way. There's no way around it. That is no way around it, so...
A thick fog often blankets the old, humid city of Bergamo. At around dusk every day, Halima joined a line of girls who stood on the sides of a long road.
We go to walk every day. We do it every day.
She wore makeup to look older and heels to look taller. A lot of those girls are African, and they've been bought and sold like Halima. Italy has a sex trafficking problem. According to the International Office of Migration, just last year, over 11,000 Nigerian women were registered coming into Sicily, and most were believed to be trafficked by ruling mafias working with Nigerian crime organizations. That's twice as much as the year before. The girls' families are often poor and desperate. They turn a blind eye. In all the years Halima spent by the side of the road, her mother never once checked in on her. Halima says it's too painful to go into that.
I really don't really want to go into that because I get very sad and I cry a lot, so I don't really want to go into that.
And when she was 15, Miriam decided to fly her out to London. This is a common move. Traffickers will take girls from place to place to avoid getting caught. And that's when one of the girls who worked with Halima gave her a phone number. A friend who might be able to help. Call her when you get to London.
She gave me a number that if I'm ready to escape, I should call that number.
So Halima hides the number under her shirt, dresses up, grabs her fake British passport. They arrive at King's Cross in London. Aunt Miriam gets on the phone. Halima runs.
So I run for about 20, 30 minutes.
She finally stops at a payphone on a corner.
So as soon as I get in the corner, I bring out the number and I beg for coins.
She begs for enough change to make that call, but where is she? She doesn't know. Her money runs out. The call drops. She begs for more change, checks the street name, calls again. An hour later, her friend comes to pick her up. After 5 years, Halima is free.
All I know is I want to stay alive. I don't want to die.
This is the part no one talks about. After all those years, freedom was terrifying. She was petrified of Miriam finding her. And not just that, she was in the UK illegally. So she was scared of getting caught. This happens to a lot of women who escape trafficking. They're too paralyzed with fear to get help.
Before, I don't trust anybody. I lost trust in humanity.
She trusted no one. She had no education, no professional skills, yet another challenge for women who escape. So for months on end, Halima just stayed indoors at her friend's house, watching television in English, a language she'd long forgotten.
Hunt for boy's mother after he's left home alone for 12 days.
She started getting these splitting headaches, night after night of insomnia, suicidal thoughts. It eventually landed her in the ER. That's where she met a doctor who had been trained to identify victims of the sex trade. "Listen," he told her, "you were trafficked." And to Halima, these words meant nothing. "No," she told him, "Aunt Miriam brought me." This is one of the hardest parts survivors have to face. Understanding what happened. Halima says it was terrifying telling the truth to this doctor. It also ended up being what saved her.
I remember I always think maybe I should have like this magical power and just strong water.
When Halima was a kid, standing on the side of the long road in Italy, she says she used to imagine she had magical powers and that she could disappear forever. She never got superpowers. Instead, she got something every bit as unlikely. Freedom from modern-day slavery. She got therapy, started processing an asylum request. And these days, she works at a bakery called Luminary, which teaches and employs survivors of trafficking. She makes cakes that are gooey and glittery, Barbie pink and soccer field green. They read, "You're a great dad," "To the best mom," and "Happy 10th birthday, Micah," with the sparkling exuberance of a girl who never got to live those moments herself. For The World, I'm Jasmine Garst.
Jasmine's story was produced by Andrea Crossan. Tomorrow, Jasmine reports on how Uganda has tried to help children who were trafficked for war. Our Across Women's Lives team also sent us this next story of a well-known Ugandan rapper. She goes only by one name, Keiko, and she's a very brave woman. Brave because after becoming successful, she had a very public battle with drugs and alcohol, and she's now talking about it with her fans, encouraging them to stay clean. But also brave because Keiko is talking about her sexuality openly for the first time. She's gay in a country where homosexuality is a crime, punishable by death. But as we're about to hear, Keiko's never gone along with anyone else's idea of how she's supposed to act or look.
I've always been a tomboy. That's the funny thing growing up. Like, even my aunts is in the village, like, they look at me now and they're like, "Oh, that one's always been like that and whatnot." But when I started doing music, everybody's like, "Oh, you're trying to be a man now because you want to rap and you want to dress like a tomboy. You're trying to be a man." I'm like, "No, I've always been like this." Make you dance,
oh, oh. Let's go.
Growing up, I just listened to songs, like singles, most of the time. And one of those singles was probably Dear Mama, for obvious reasons, Tupac. You all appreciate it. Dear Mama. You all appreciate it. And then, maybe like in high school, probably 50 Cent, Get Rich or Die Trying. I listened to that and I was like, "Wow, this is really nice stuff. Maybe I can try this out, you know." Dear mama, I'm a millionaire. Dear mama, I'm a billionaire.
spreading propaganda. Chris pretty when he see me make his girlfriend ponder. Giving nothing back, new this, new that.
I went through like a phase in my life where I got really depressed after I signed my recording contract. I was having relationship issues and then musical issues, and I'm very passionate about my music, and if my music is not going how it's supposed to, I kind of get very anxious and very restless and very depressed. So all that was happening at the same time, and I got really depressed, so I started drinking alcohol. I started smoking weed, marijuana, and I didn't know that actually when you do that, it actually adds to the depression, you know, instead of suppressing it. So it actually got to a point where I think my brain just checked out almost, and I just had an emotional break. You know, I had to like go to rehab and go to a psychiatrist and whatnot.
More money, more problems. Now we got a pocket full before the two girlfriends. Now we got like 42. He brags to his pals about how he got it made. Wednesdays at the Bay, Thursdays at the Cayenne. Sipping on gin, sipping, smoking on trees. By the bar for the night, so many things he wanna be. But later that night in his bed, he sheds tears. He has it all, but he can't leave past his fears. For years the skeletons pile up, yeah, they still come up, yeah, they will get up. They are a part of him, which means that they stay with him. And there's no running away from his self-esteem. Dear God, not tonight, not today. Lord, I pray, take me away from this life. I don't wanna fade away. I don't wanna fade away.
I'm sure everybody in the entire country knows I'm gay. You know, but they probably are still in denial or whatnot. But I am not. And I speak on it because there's so many kids out there that are like that. And it's not like people always have that notion where they say, oh, it's such a Western thing. They're copying it from the movies. Or so I speak on it because I feel like people need to live more freer lives, you know. And in Africa, of course, this is still a lot of time before that happens, but I mean, if they can look back and be like, but Keiko wasn't, you know, she was not afraid to you know, be open about it and stand up for herself, then I can just be myself.
British state dreams got me reading out of the dictionary. Paid up, stay quiet, this for the learned folks at the missionary. Suicide in the beat, started off basic, started from the bar, now we hit. Everybody know how I go, how I dominate DC, can you holler, let me know. Should I do it for the kill, do it for the young MC, trying to reach for the peak end. Do it for the kill, do it for the times when we used to break bread with a weak hand. Can't help feeling like I'm never growing up, never land dreams when I'm in a hurry up. Fast, fast life, can't help but hurry up, more money, more love, people hate coming up. Expensive taste.
Ugandan rapper Keiko there with her song DMIM. Her latest album is called Strides. The phrase world music was coined as a marketing term mostly 30 years ago. Yeah, time does fly. Initially, it was just a way to organize music from around the globe so people could find it and buy it. But then a lot of people developed a dislike for that phrase, world music. And they said, and still say, it ghettoizes the music and divides the world into us and them. So this year, to mark that 30th anniversary, we're talking to a lot of artists about what world music really means to them. Artists with a personal connection to it, like Bonnie Raitt.
Woke up this morning, I'm feeling around in my shoes. You know bad that I must have had them while walking blues. Woke up this morning, people, I'm feeling around in my shoes. Well, you know bad that I must have had them walking blues.
Hearing this, you might be wondering just what that connection is. It's simple: when she plays the blues. A few years ago, Bonnie Raitt recognized that the roots of the blues go way beyond the American South, reaching across the Atlantic to West Africa, a part of the world she visited back in 2000.
Even the first day when I stood on the banks of the Niger River, it really felt like the roots of the blues.
She says that moment was holy and sacred. Everything about the blues, the past, present, and future, coalesced for her.
There was just something incredibly evocative about the blues, especially the Delta blues, that made me really understand, even though I grew up in Southern California, a privileged daughter of somebody singing Broadway songs, I got it. And I think that's why the Stones love it and the rest of the world was turned on to this music. It's real. It's coming from a place of incredible pain and survival and hope and perseverance and longing and anger. I mean, all of the emotions, it makes it the kind of music that will stand the test of time forever because it just speaks to the heart.
Yes, my daddy told me.
Yeah, he did.
Leave that man alone.
Yeah, he did.
But my daddy didn't tell me, Lord God, where the man was put down.
Down,
baby.
Down.
I'm in the mood for some of your love.
This is Bonnie Raitt playing with the late American blues legend John Lee Hooker. Her passion for the blues led to another collaboration with someone even closer to the roots of the blues, Ali Farka Touré from Mali.
Well, I had been such a fan of the African guitar from the time when I got to play the Winnipeg Festival in the 80s, I believe, with King Sunny Ade. And then Ali Farka and I met, and I'm just such a fan of that modal kind of North Africa Tuareg bleeding down into the whole areas of Mali and West Africa where the blues really came from. And having studied it a long time ago, I was drawn to the kind of more modal sounds of the Mississippi Delta. And of course, the urbanized sounds of John Lee Hooker to me sounded so much like what Ali Farka was doing.
Landi futu futu o makoi hum jergi nenda mali baite warbi gosa.
Before Ali Farka Touré died in 2006, he and Bonnie Raitt found numerous occasions to play together. It was her love and respect for the African roots of the blues that got Ali Farka Touré on the bill for a special World Blues Party at the Hollywood Bowl back in 2000. Were you able to kind of talk to each other on guitars in a way that you hadn't expected or maybe did expect it?
Well, having sat in with a lot of different people over the years, the blues makes that format much easier to sit in on than some other song. But because it's just so natural for me to play along and sit in with people that are playing that kind of music, it's so bluesy in the first place. I guess I'm just, if I started out in my early 20s trying to play with him, I think I would have been intimidated. But over the years, I've gotten pretty comfortable.
Do you remember the first time you heard Ali Farka Touré's guitar, and did it sound like the source of your music?
Well, I don't only do blues, and the blues that I've done over the years, I wouldn't say sound like the kind of music that's coming out of Mali, but certainly my slide guitar playing and the way that I sing and the way that I hear things, that's one of my favorite sounds of music, West African in particular, and South Africa, but West African for blues guitar. Those artists, especially Ali Farka, were the ones that really appealed to me. And he was just the guy. He was the cat, you know, and he was so loquacious and generous and very enthusiastic about collaborating. So I was just knocked out by his playing.
That West African sound echoes the blues, and any student of the blues can hear this. Even a layperson can. Ultimately, though, it wasn't an academic approach to digging out the Delta blues from a distant source, Mali, that captivated Bonnie Raitt to this iteration of world music. It was physically being in Mali in a musical context, like that moment Bonnie mentioned earlier, standing on the banks of the Niger River.
For the next 2 weeks, we traveled around in 4x4s and slept in the desert and the Dogon country, and went to Timbuktu and heard the Tuareg Jimi Hendrix serenade us in the middle of the night, when the middle with a portable amp, walking in the desert. You haven't lived until you've crouched at the side of a town square with somebody with a turban on, dressed like a Tuareg guy, playing an electric guitar like Jimi Hendrix with a long cord.
Well, Bonnie Raitt, thank you very much for sharing your time and your thoughts. Really appreciate it.
Marco, thank you so much for the great shows you do day in and day out. I learned so much, and in these bleary times, weary and bleary times and scary times, it's like an oasis. So thank you very much for honoring me, letting me talk to you.
This song, by the way, is Tamatan Tile by Tinariwen. And yeah, I hear Hendrix, and you probably do too. That's all from us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.